Accession number 10430, Rule 3.
Gadsden, Rule 3.
Yes, having got to the banks of the Irrawaddy, the whole of the 7th Indian Division was then pushed through across, heading for Maitilla, including tanks. The whole thing was just a race because there were no Japanese. It was a race across the central plain of Burma, which is quite sort of desert country. We're out of the jungle now. It's not all Burmese jungle there. It's open sandy country with just a few bushes. And the tanks and the armoured cars and so on just raced across there to capture Maitilla, which would cut off the whole of the Japanese army up in Mandalay to the north. And that's exactly what happened. That was the strategy for that part of Burma, was to cut them off and destroy them before they could get away. My own problem there was that there was a regiment, the 33rd Regiment Japanese, made an attack on us on our bank of the Irrawaddy, coming up from the Arakan towards us. And they were obviously trying to hit our army in the flank and cut off the people who'd crossed over and gone to Maitilla. So I was detached, and the 4th 14th Punjab Regiment were detached with the Gordon Highlanders tanks, and sent to a place called Letsi, which was about 40, 50 miles away, not far from the bank of the Irrawaddy, but on the west bank, and whereas Maitilla and all the rest were away to the east. And we were sent there to stop this Japanese 33rd Regiment from attacking us in the flank. And we set up our usual box at Letsi and pushed forward to make contact with this regiment, which we very quickly did. And I suppose that that was the hardest fighting that we had in the whole of the Burma campaign, in fact, in and around Letsi.
Can you describe any of it from your personal position?
Probably the description in the letter that I sent home to my mother is probably better than anything of the fighting at Letsi, because those were the actual words that I used at the time. We were cut off and surrounded on a hill at Letsi for 3 or 4 weeks, but we knew by then we were able to open up way at night so that we could get rations in and get ammunition in. But the Japanese were pressing up more and more towards us. And in the end, they did attack the box in Letsi village itself, where the tanks were normally at night, and where all the ammunition dump was and everything else, and where the rations came to and so on. And they did attack this box in the night in quite considerable numbers, and they got actually inside the box. And at dawn, I was sent for by the brigadier to take a company, two platoons first of all, and then full three platoons back, to get these Japs out of the box. Because the whole thing was very chancy as to whether we'd be able to hold on or whether we should have to withdraw ourselves. And I'd never seen a sight quite like that, because they'd broken into the box over a wire fence which had a machine gun firing along it. And when I got there, there were 38 Japanese who'd actually been caught between the wire and the machine gun. They couldn't retreat because the machine gun was firing straight down the wire. They couldn't get ahead because they couldn't get over the wire. And so they'd taken out hand grenades, set them off and put them down their shirt fronts, which was the Japanese soldiers' way of going to heaven rather than be captured. And this was why it was a tough war. Nobody took any prisoners. The Japanese didn't want to be prisoners. There was, in fact, a fortnight's leave going to anybody who captured a Japanese prisoner for interrogation. And there were these 38 corpses draped over the and around the barbed wire with all their insides blown out with a hand grenade. A nasty way to end, but fairly quick, I suppose. And so I took my troops. The people inside the box by then had thrown the remainder of the Japanese out, and the brigadier said to me, I want you to clear Songon village. Yes, that's the name of the place, Songon. And it was across a plain, Maidan, maybe 300 or 400 yards across, and then a hill on the other side with some pagodas on it and trees. Take your two platoons and clear Songon village. And I must say I felt a bit exposed setting off across there, because we were walking across, or moving across in extended order, across a plain which was 400 yards across, absolutely open to anybody to see. And I thought, golly, if anybody's got a machine gun, we've had it. And my orderly was beside me with a Tommy gun, old Warris, and I saw something move under a bush in front, and I said, Warris, Dushman, enemy. And he up with his Tommy gun, and he was so excited that the first bullets hit the ground just in front of his feet, and after that it sprayed about all over the place. So I said, hey, wait a minute. And I took out my rifle, and because all officers carried rifles if you had any sense. You never carried a pistol. If you carried a pistol, you just got sniped at by the Japanese. So we were wise enough then to carry rifles.
Because they recognised you as an officer.
That's right. If you had a pistol, you were an officer or a signaller. If you had a rifle, hopefully, you know, you were just one of the troops. So I used to wear a steel helmet and carry a rifle. I never bothered with blacking my face or anything, because by then I suppose I was as sunburnt as any Pathan. Not all Indians are the same sort of deep black colour as the Madrasi people. In fact, the Pathans from up on the northwest frontier, who normally keep their bodies fairly well covered, are just about the same shade that we are when we're thoroughly sunburnt. So I shot at this chap, and I scored a hit, and when we got there, we found he was a Japanese officer, and in fact, it's his sword hanging on the wall in the next room. I took his sword off him, put him on a stretcher, and sent him back to be interrogated. He's in a very bad way, and I understand that the chap died before they got any information out of him, other than the fact that he was 33 Regiment of Japanese. And so we continued up the hill into Songon village, and suddenly came under fire from a machine gun, which made us all lie down fairly smartly. But there were Japanese wounded and so on all about all over the place. And one in particular I hoped to capture, and I came on this chap and shouted at him, hands up, not knowing any Japanese, and sort of made an indication I wanted him to put his hands up. And all he did was to lift up a hand grenade. So I hastily backed off and said to the troops with me, so lie down, lie down. They all lay down and nothing happened. So I got up and advanced again and said, hands up. And he did the same thing. And the third time that I did it, he banged the hand grenade to set the fuse off, put it down his shirt front and blew himself up. So, no prisoner. And by that time, we found that we were up to the main Japanese position there. They were digging trenches, digging themselves in. And we did come under fire, and we were the whole morning there messing about, trying to get round these trenches. And I managed to get a reserve platoon of East African soldiers. By midday, I called in the three-inch mortars and mortared these trenches, and still not shifted the machine gun, because we put in your actual bayonet attack. We ran in with the fixed bayonets, and all that happened was that the chap next to me got his arm shot off, and there was another chap wounded and down on the ground. So we had to withdraw.
When was this?
This was sort of mid-morning, I suppose.
Do you remember the day?
Oh dear, do you mean the date of the actual date in the year?
Or just the month?
Let's see, would be May, I suppose, wouldn't it? I don't really think. Oh, wait a minute. Here we are. Let's see, would be April, May of 45. Yes, April, May time, 45. And at any rate, at the end of the day, we'd got these Japanese so punch drunk one way and another, we put in this other East African platoon, that late in the afternoon they got out of their trenches and charged us, which was exactly, you know, what we hoped they might do, because we killed them all. There were 36 of them who were laid out, as I recall. And so that was one action that I was in. Typical sort of infantry action, I suppose. And indeed, yes, I got a military cross, in fact, out of that. So, yes, I was given the military cross afterwards, because the brigadier thought it was a good day's shooting, as he said. Yes.
I think John Masters, in his book on the road past Mandalay, or whatever it's called, his autobiography about Burma, says that most of the Japanese infantry, if they were in our army, would get VCs. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, I know John Masters extremely well, or did before he died. He was, in fact, my brigade major at Buck Creole. And, yes, many's the long chat I've had with John Masters. He was Chindits, of course, after he moved off from the 7th Indian Division, where he was a brigade major in 114 Brigade. He then took command in the Chindits. And their sort of fighting became much tougher, perhaps, than anything that we actually saw, because they were used in a role which they weren't really intended for towards the end. The idea of the Chindits was to drop them in behind the enemy lines, appear out of the jungle, smash everything up, disappear. But unfortunately, they were put into places like White City and so on, where they were told to fight to the last round and the last man. Now, that's not what the Chindits were intended for. And John Master saw that sort of fighting. And he's absolutely right, of course, that the Japanese would put a hand grenade down their shirt front if they looked like being captured. I mean, we don't think that way. And to give you a typical example, at Letsi, Gordon Highlanders, one of their tanks, they probably have this somewhere in their annals, that they came out to help us one day up our hill, where I told you I was cut off and surrounded, and the Japs were all round, and the tanks came out to see what they could do to help us. And as they got down on the plain below our hill, a Jap came running out. He climbed over the louvers at the back of the tank where the exhaust comes out. He ran along the tank and put a hand grenade down the barrel of the gun. And the hand grenade ran down inside and exploded inside the tank and killed the driver, who fell on the controls. And the tank was going round and round in circles at full throttle with a dead crew inside and this Japanese riding on the top. Now, anybody who can do that sort of thing certainly deserves a VC. And he was shot off, in fact, by the next tank coming along, who turned a machine gun on him and shot him off. But that was typical of the sort of thing that they would do.
Can you tell me what John Masters was like from your personal experience of him?
Oh, yes. He was a fine soldier, of course, John Masters. A good leader of men and just what you would expect a regular Indian Army officer to be, in fact. Very capable, wonderful linguist. He could speak all their languages. And his books, I think, simply reflect, 100 years or more of family history of the Masters family.
From reading this particular book I mentioned, I get the impression he was a rather argumentative sort of chap, was he?
Well, certainly in Bugles and a Tiger, not The Road Past Mandalay, Bugles and a Tiger, I think you find one or two examples of it. Masters wasn't easily put upon, and towards the end of The Road Past Mandalay, yes, he said that his troops had had enough and they should be taken out, and was nearly court-martialed over it. But of course he was absolutely right, because their Chindits only went in for a certain time, and gradually their health deteriorated, malaria and so on. And they anticipated being taken out, I forget, within 3-4 months or something. And they were kept on there in really hard fighting until they were just medically unfit to be there. And yes, he was an argumentative chap, perhaps.
Did you like him?
Oh, yes, yes. I had a great deal of time for John Masters, yes, as the brigade major. We were in Buckreol. I didn't see him after he left 7th Indian Division. We were putting a team together, and we all got to know each other extremely well and trust each other to give sensible orders and do things right and so on. And John Masters was a fine soldier, there's no doubt.
Now, I interrupted you with you being awarded the MC.
Yes.
Could you pick it up from there, please?
Yes, well, after Letzi, I think the final thing was a night patrol that I had to do down to a village ahead of us at Letzi. The colonel said to me one night, "Will you take a fighting patrol and go and tell me whether Guaybin village is occupied by the Japanese?" Which was what patrolling was all about. You had to go out. A standing patrol just had to go and listen. A reconnaissance patrol had to go and make a reconnaissance, but never to fight, and consisted of just a few men. And a marvellous example of a reconnaissance patrol was actually at Letzi, where I sent out a Havildar sergeant and three men, and said, "Go to point 549 and tell me whether the Japanese are there." And so it came dawn, and the three men came back and said to me, "Well, they're there all right, Saab. You heard the firing in the night. The Japanese are there, but poor old Havildar, I forget his name, I'm afraid he's had it, because he was right forward, creeping up the hill. The Japanese opened fire and so on. It terrible, and he's gone. So I said, oh dear. So I look out across this flat plain to the hills opposite where the Japanese are, and 0.539, whatever it was, and there in the distance is a figure trudging up my side, and it's the Havildar coming back. And he said to me, Saab, he said, I've been to 0.539, as you said, the Japanese are there. And he said, when they opened fire on me from about 15 or 16 foot away, I crawled under a bush. And he said, they spent all night running about looking for me. He said, but they're blind as bats and they can't see anything. And then at dawn, they withdrew. So I came home. So he said, I can tell you that 0.539 is occupied just at night by a small standing patrol of Japanese. And so I said, that's exactly what I wanted to know. Thank you very much. That's a reconnaissance patrol. And a fighting patrol, you take more men, two platoons I took, and you go down and lay an ambush or beat somebody up, or generally the colonel said, find out where the Gui Bin is occupied, and if it is, shoot them up. And so I went off down there, and it's a creepy business. You just put on gym shoes and you carry small arms rifles and Tommy guns and bandoliers of ammunition and hand grenades, and you creep down there and try and find out where the enemy's positions are. And in fact, we crept out, mile and a half, I suppose, and finally came right on a complete Japanese position, all trenches and everything all laid out. Not a soul in it. They'd all left a day or so before. But we could see a light in one of the houses in Gui Bin village. So what you do is set up a layback position, which I set up in the trenches, and rendezvous, so that everybody rendezvous back there. And then sent one platoon into the village. And they went right through the village and didn't, in fact, find any Japanese at all. So the Japanese were starting to withdraw. We realised then that they'd cleared off ahead of us. And we followed them up right down to the bank of the Irrawaddy and crossed over there to Minbu, which is south of Yennanyong, the oil fields. And then we went from there to Prome, and Burma is a bit sort of pear-shaped, like a pear upside down. It's wide at the north and it comes down to a fair stem down towards Rangoon. And in the middle of the stem is the Pegu Yomas, which are very mountainous, jungle-covered hills. And the plan of campaign was the Japanese were withdrawing and obviously trying to get away towards Thailand, towards Malaya, and places that they were still occupying, while we pushed down from Mike Tiller, having destroyed their army around Mandalay. We made a run for Rangoon, down the railway and the road, and alongside the Solween River. And the idea on our side, from the Irrawaddy side of the Pegu Yomas, was to push the Japanese up into the Pegu Yomas and let them come down the Solween side. As the Pegu Yomas is quite famous as being one of the most malarial places in the world, and a retreating army has no rations and no medicine and so on. And so the Japanese were pushed into these malarial hills, and we tore around the other side to meet them coming out. That was the strategy of the end of the war in Burma. And we went right down to Rangoon and then up the other side of the Pegu Yomas. turning back towards Mandalay, and met the Japanese army coming out of the Pegu Yomis. And it was not a pleasant battle at all, because the paddy fields were all covered in water by then. We're now sort of August 45 into the monsoon, and the whole place was covered with water, and the Japanese simply would not surrender. They intended to get out of the Pegu Yomis, to cross the Salween River and disappear into Thailand. But they were in a desperately bad state. A lot of them had no arms, no equipment, very little uniform. And on a given day, which we'd captured the operation order for, somewhere or other in those parts, they came out of the forest, and our troops opened fire, and I'm afraid an awful lot of Japanese were killed. And I don't think there's a great deal said about this in the annals, in the history of the war in Burma. It wasn't a very glorious battle, but they were absolutely decimated, and those that didn't get shot drowned in the Salween River, I would think. I suppose some of them got away into Thailand, but not a great many. And I wasn't right forward in that. I was rather near Rangoon, and was quite quickly told to get an aeroplane in September and fly into Bangkok, where I led the victory march down into Bangkok with the 414th Punjab Regiment. We swung down into the city and took over the school of building in the middle of Bangkok. And then I stayed.
Did you get a good reception from the
Oh yes, I mean everybody claimed to be pleased to see us, the Thais, and we put the Japanese war criminals into their jails. The Kempai Thai, the Japanese military police in particular, because of course they were looking for the individuals who'd mistreated our prisoners on the Burma Railway and that sort of thing. But it was all Dutch prisoners from the Dutch East Indies, looking like skeletons in Bangkok. But however, we got our own back, because we got all the Japanese generals and put them in little cages in Bangkok.